Welcome to the Silver Shield Report number 23. Today we're going to be discussing Iran, Israel, and the future of the petrodollar. So this is becoming more of an issue. I stated at the beginning of the year that there has to be some physical, real interruption in the debt-based paradigm in order for this to collapse. The system will not collapse because of debt crises or government's not meeting bond auctions, because all those things can be papered over. There has to be a physical interruption in the physical world that can't be papered over, that can't be propagandized, spun. You know, there has to be something where the lights go out, something doesn't get delivered. And the two things that I just see over and over again has to be oil in the Persian Gulf or a silver default on the COMEX. Something that would, shake the foundations of this petrodollar paradigm. If the silver starts rocketing up, people would start seeing that the dollar has less and less value, and there'd be a rush out of the dollar into more physical assets. The simple fact that Germany and Switzerland are now starting to ask where their gold is, that it's being stored at the Federal Reserve in New York. Shows to me that that's a physical problem that could be there, because this gold could be loaned out or leased out or just simply confiscated by the Fed, much like how I think our gold in Fort Knox has been used as a collateral for Fed loans and stuff like that, and we'll never know until the day we open up the vaults and say, hey, this isn't our stuff. But Germany and Switzerland never had those arrangements. And they have all their gold still there. So that's a physical thing that could very, interrupt this whole fiat debt paper paradigm that we have. So the war drums seem to be really picking up, especially with Israel, really putting the screws on Obama to get a war started with Iran. And I have to remind everybody, this war, this coming war with Iran, has nothing to do with their nuclear development. This has everything to do with the petrodollar. We've seen this before with Libya, with Gaddafi, and most of you guys know, because I've even stated this publicly. Gaddafi was moving towards establishing a gold dinar for the MENA region, the Middle East, North Africa region, to transfer gold for oil, which would be a huge blow to the petrodollar paradigm. Saddam, same thing. When he started selling oil for euros, that's when he had to go. It's when these guys finally make that move. Well, Iran made that move in 2008, and this has been festering for 4 years now. I've shown the videos of Seymour Hersh talking about how Dick Cheney wanted to plot a false flag attack of having Americans attacking a ship. And then blaming the Iranians. This is public knowledge, and this is something that I think is a real possibility. But believe it or not, I think Obama is the only reason why we haven't had this war. Because if there was another neocon in there, this probably would have kicked off a long time ago. Especially considering the fact that the Iranians stopped selling oil for dollars, and they're the third largest oil exporter in the world, and that they're selling it not just for euros like in with Saddam's case, but they're selling it for any currency out there, including gold. So what I want to start with is our history with Iran. I think it's very misunderstood. I'm somebody who grew up thinking, wow, these are a bunch of crazy Muslims out there, and they're going to blow up the world and stuff like that. And to be honest, if you look at it from the Iranian perspective, they're actions are very rational, considering how much the Anglo-American Empire has been messing around with them. So, if you want to really get back to the modern, Iranian state, you have to really go back to the, right around the 1940s, 1930s, somewhere around there, and the British involvement in the development of their oil there. So the Middle East was pretty much a wide open Arab, Bedouin land, back in, during the time of Lawrence of Arabia, those 30s and 40s there, and that the, the British corporate model of you know, taking over a nation without having troops there necessarily has always been in the providing assistance, providing development costs, providing, you know, this, and they're, you know, bringing their technical expertise and military assistance, and propping up local, you know, regimes there. So the first big guy that they set up there was a Persian monarch named Shah Muzaffar. And this guy was, you know, it was like, and I don't want to say caveman, but he was just like so backwoods, you know, like his wealth was in camels and stuff like that. And like when they gave him like a Rolls Royce, that was like, you know, oh wow, like, you know, he'd never seen a car, much less one that nice. And the British oil companies cut a deal with the Iranian monarch there. Get this. The Iranians would get $20,000, so let's say 20,000 ounces of silver, because it was, you know, it was, we were still on the silver standard back then, and 16% of whatever was found in Iran. So basically, the British went in there with 20 grand, and they get 84% of all the oil that's found in Iran. And of course, they're going to provide the technical expertise and the, you know, military backing for the strong man to stay there. So let's flash forward. So that lasted for probably about 20 years, and then in 1948, the Iranian people protested to the UN about having these British foreign troops leave their countries, and they did, but the financial power stayed. So in 1948, BP made $320 million in profits while paying Iran only $36 million in royalties, according to their deal. And the Iranians are like, you know what, that was great, but that was also 20 years ago, and this is our oil, and we want to negotiate a new deal. So how about we come true partners and do a 50-50 split? And BP is like, uh-uh, you know, that's not going to happen. So after that, I think rational, you know, renegotiation of saying, hey, you know, things have changed. You know, this is our oil. We don't think getting 16% of the profits is really a good deal, considering you guys are making, you know, $320 million and you're only leaving us with $36 million. How about a 50-50 split? So finally, the Iranians said, you know what? Fine. You don't want 50-50. We'll take it all. We'll nationalize the whole thing. So that's what happened. The Iranian people rebelled against the economic rape of their nationalized resource and installed a democratically led leader named Mohammad Mossadegh. So Mossadegh's first thing that he did when he got into office was nationalize all the oil. He said, you know what, BP, try to negotiate with you 50-50, but now we're going to take it all. And, you know, they sold that oil for higher prices, too. So even though BP, you know, showed $320 million in profits and only paying Iran $36 million, most of the money is actually made in the upstream process, the refining, the value-added part of the business. In fact, even today, it benefits the Anglo-American Empire to suppress real commodity prices, whether it's corn, oil, silver, you know, anything that they actually have to get from other countries, because that money... you know, they spread debt to all these other, you know, foreign nations, these third country nations, in order for them to develop the resources. But then they suppress the prices so they can never really pay back these debts. Meanwhile, the corporations that harvest these resources are then able to buy them much cheaper than they probably could if they didn't have this paradigm set up. And that allows them to have more corporate profits higher up the stream in these value-added things, because the commodities that go into creating these things are very small. You know, you look at like a box of cereal, it probably costs you $4, but the actual amount of corn that's in the cereal is probably only, I don't know, 50 cents or 30 cents of it, and the rest of it goes into the marketing and the advertising, all the other, you know, garbage that goes into it. But even for farmers today, like, you can't go out and grow corn profitably without having government subsidies at home. And that lowers the value of corn on the world market, because now we're able to flood the world with cheap corn, and that gets other countries dependent upon us. In fact, the reason why there's so many problems in Mexico right now is because the United States has made corn so cheap that Mexican farmers that have been doing it for centuries can no longer keep up. And that's why we saw a huge increase in the population of Mexico City, The drug gangs are becoming more profitable down there because they're the only ones that are able to grow anything that has any value, namely marijuana, because that's illegal. And even with silver today, silver is suppressed because then corporations that use silver can then have cheaper input processes, allowing them to make bigger profits. And you'll see that with all over and over again with these commodities. So the point is that, you know, in 1948, BP made $320 million in profits while only paying Iran $36 million. That is even a lower number because the actual value of that oil was much higher. So the Iranians said, hey, we're going to take it all. And the first thing that Mossadegh did when he was the first democratically elected leader of Iran, Mossadegh immediately nationalized in 1951 all the Iranian oil and then sold that oil for higher prices. So, you know, I don't know what it was, like a dollar a barrel and then made it $2 a barrel or something. But he not only took the majority or the portion of the oil that was available to go out of there, but then he also raised the value of it. So the British were in a quandary because they just lost their huge deal. And they knew that this is something that they couldn't do by themselves. So they looked towards the Americans for assistance. And the Americans sent in Theodore Roosevelt's grandson, Kermit Roosevelt, who was a CIA agent, to operate Operation Ajax, which is our first big takedown of these countries. And this is such a key point in the turn from America being, you know, after World War II, being, you know, we saved the world from fascism and you know, we're fighting against communism, to now actually overthrowing popularly elected governments who go against us in economic deals. So the Anglo-American Empire was no longer able to, you know, basically steal all this oil out of there, and these people had the balls of standing up and saying, hey, this isn't right, and we're going to renegotiate and make it our favor if you're not going to go along. But in Operation Ajax, he went in there, went into Iran, and bribed and threatened enough people to organize street riots and did terror plots to show that Mossadegh, you know, making it look like Mossadegh's government was being oppressive to the people. And they fomented a revolution there. And Mossadegh was eventually captured and spent the rest of his life in jail. And I found a really good quote from a relative. I think this is like a nephew of Mossadegh. And they just didn't get it back then. He said, and this is a quote, America, or why did you, America, do such a terrible thing? We loved America. To us, America was a great country, the perfect country, the country that helped us while all other countries were exploiting us. But after that moment, no one in Iran ever trusted the United States again. All of your troubles started in 1955, or 1953 when they did that. Why did you do it? And the answer is oil. Everything has to go back down to oil. The whole world revolves around oil. They've created a petrodollar that runs off of oil. And oil is the energy that, fuels all the industries and that provides all the economic power and basis for the monetary system. So that's where we went wrong. You know, when we started selling out our, you know, what we were founded on, you know, with democracy and constitutional rights and defending freedom and all that other stuff, to now becoming, you know, economic hitmen, overthrowing democratically elected people who were fighting against bad deals that were cut from them, you know, years before. So what happened after this? The Anglo-American Empire now installed Mohammad Reza, the Shah, as dictator. And, you know, they provided him with capital and military and police assistance, technical expertise, and more importantly, foreign legitimacy. So now, now they had this Western-style dictator in Iran. It was no longer a Bedouin or, you know, the Imams that we see today. I mean, this guy was sharp-dressed. He wore military garb. He very Westernized. He played well to the press and everything. And they used any attempts to fight against the Shah, which is this obvious American-supported dictator there. Anybody who was against them, for whatever reasons, were painted as communists. So, you know, the nationalistic Iranians who were like, you know, we don't want this American puppet in here. We want, we want Mossadegh, or we want, somebody who's going to care about us and not, you know, give good deals to the Americans. And they were all painted as communists, and that worked for many years. So for many years, he ruled and the government became stronger and the middle and lower classes became poor and actually feared the secret police. So they had the SAVAK, S-A-V-A-K, and that was like their, ultra secret police that came around. They would black bag people in the middle of the night. You would never hear from them again. Very, very dirty stuff. And that's, again, Americans enabled all this stuff. So this worked great for the Anglo-American Empire, that they were able to, get oil contracts with the Shah that put him in power. And just like they did in Saudi Arabia, hey, you sell oil for dollars, we'll give you support and information and technologies and cars or whatever you want. And, we'll continue to back you. But then the Shah started to make some, choices that went against the United States. And the first thing that he did was that, with this new higher oil prices from this concocted oil embargoes and crisis that we saw in the 70s, he started using the newfound wealth that he created and wanted to create a modern energy infrastructure. So in 1974, right after the 1973 oil shock, Iran signed a deal, and this not a lot of people know about this. Iran signed a deal to buy 5 nuclear power plants from France, and then next year expanded it to 8. 2 years later, Iran signed a deal with Germany for 6 more reactors. And then by 1978, Iran had the 4th largest nuclear program in the world. And the key here is that France and Germany started that, started supplying that. So here's 2 nations that do not benefit from the current Anglo-American Empire. Right around the time of the creation of the petrodollar, remember 1971, Nixon took us off the gold standard. 1973 was the first oil shock. It was a Bilderberg-created false crisis that was run by Henry Kissinger with the shuttle diplomacy. The Arabs would say, hey, we denounce the Western world for supporting Israel. But, oh, by the way, we're going to only sell our oil for dollars, the great Satan's dollar, and then invest all of our money back into the United States. And so if you ever wondered why, all these Arab countries hated us but then gave us all the money back, it's because that was the creation of the petrodollar. But France and Germany looked at that and said, hey, wow, the Anglo-Americans have a really good deal where they can print now unbacked currency. And remember, France got screwed when Nixon took us off the international gold standard because you remember Charles de Gaulle was actually trading in euro dollars, dollars that were abroad, for gold. And that's what forced Nixon to close the gold window. And then 2 years later, they do this petrodollar thing. So Germany and France got together and say, hey, you know what? They don't like Iran. We can do deals with Iran. Let's do that. So they created all these nuclear power plants for Iran. And 1978 was also the first year that Germany and France got together on putting together the euro. It was a continental monetary system that would act as a buffer from the dominant petrodollar that was just being established. So here's France and Germany making inroads with Iran, not only to give them nuclear power, which would allow them to export more, but also, make nice with them, and maybe act as a backing towards a petro-euro. That same year, October 1978, negotiations collapsed in Iran about a renewal of a 25-year oil lease with the Anglo-Americans. November 1978, Zbigniew Brzezinski recommends to Washington to drop support for the Shah and adapt a new Middle Eastern foreign policy. And we know what Brzezinski was all about. Brzezinski was all about, he studied Islamic fundamentalism as a way of creating disorder in the Middle East along religious and ethnic boundaries that he knew would spill into the Muslim regions of Russia, because at that point, the Cold War was at, coming to a peak. He felt that the best way of beating Russia was to have them go into Afghanistan. We were actually in Afghanistan training the Mujahideen, the precursor to Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda, however you want to look at it. They actually provoked Russia to invade Afghanistan by doing all these terrorist attacks 6 months before they actually said it. And Brzezinski has come out and admitted to that, that they wanted to create foment this Islamic fundamentalism along Russia's borders because it would benefit them. Plus, there's also the benefit of balkanization of a nation. You know, if you have all these factions fighting against each other, just like in divide and conquer with, you know, social issues in the United States, when people are fighting amongst each other, they never bother looking up at the guys that are profiting off of this, you know, disorder. You know, in this case, it would be through, you know, the oil sales. 1978 comes around, and Brzezinski, you know, pushes this thing, and the British go along with it because the Shah is actually getting cozier with the French and the Germans, and you know that, and then you know has this oil contract that goes bad with the Anglo-Americans in October 1978. They said, okay, now the Shah's got to go. So the British created the economic conditions necessary for revolution. And again, this is very important because this is the exact same game plan that we're going through right now with Iran. They limited the exports of oil that drove down capital inflows into Iran, causing the populace to be upset. And of course, most people don't understand what's going on. They organized capital flight out of Iran through their banks, which hurts their local currencies, causes economic disorder. They also did not allow the Shah to use the British controlled media to organize the people. So, you know, the BBC was very popular in Iran at the time. So when all this popular uprising was coming on, the Shah had no way of communicating to the people. But the BBC gave full attention to the Ayatollah and gave him full propaganda control over the media. Boy, what was it? Two, three months later, January 1979, the Shah fled Iran, and then the next month the Ayatollah was flown in. It was like a big press thing. I mean, I remember him coming off the plane, and I think he was in France at the time. But in May 1979, the Ayatollah canceled all the French and German nuclear power programs. You know, like qui bono, like the very first thing. So here we had, here we have now the radicalization of Islam. Now we have, instead of democratically elected Mossadegh, instead of the Anglo-American dictator, now we have this religious fundamentalist backing towards this new paradigm in Iran, and they have the younger generation wrapped up into this, you know, becoming more religious and under unified under this religion. As a result of the younger generation growing up in fear of the Anglo-American Savak, you know, the Shah Savak. The destruction of the middle class because of this top-down economic system that we put in there to extract all the wealth out of Iran, so that the the young people identified with the religious the radical religious people who said, you know, this isn't the way we're supposed to live, and they overthrew the Shah, and you know this is where it gets a little murkier. Because at the exact same time, you know, the Shah comes in. Here is this, you know, again, another anti-American religious guy. The United States is making deals behind the scenes to basically said if the Iranians would release the hostages, because Carter, that's when the U.S. Embassy was taken over. There was, I don't know, 440 days of Americans being held hostage. The neocons of the time, the George Bushes and the Ronald Reagans of the time said, hey, you know what? Iranians, don't release the hostages after Reagan gets into office, and we'll provide weapons to you. And this took place with the Iran-Contra affair. So here we have, under the flag of fighting communism, a few elite members had secret and illegal dealings with the Iranians to sell them weapons and use the proceeds to fund the Contras. And, you know, now we got drug trade, arms trade, all this other stuff. And what the Iranians didn't know is that we were doing the exact same deal with Saddam. So we're assisting Saddam with weapons and intelligence to conquer the Iranians. And I remember one quote from, I want to say, Alexander Haig or Don Regan or, you know, one of those guys back then. And he said, it's a shame that we can't have them kill them all off. Well, they sure did give a good try, because they had the Iranians and the Iraqis fighting for 8 years in this bloody Iran-Iraq war. Assisting both sides until they were exhausted, and Iran lost 1 million men in this eight-year battle, and a whole generation was gutted for them, all for oil. You know, so you wonder why the Iranians don't trust us. Look what we've done to them. You know, even up until the '80s, screwing them out of oil deals and then overthrowing their democratically elected guy, installing a dictator, the Savak. They finally overthrow them. Then we get involved in an 8-year war that they're fighting against Iraq. And finding out that the Americans are funding both sides of it, making profits off of war, and then the oil prices and all this other stuff. And then to throw on top of it, we give Saddam chemical weapons that he ends up using against his own people, trying to blame it on the Iranians, who had nothing to do with it, because they were starting to win. So I wanted to give this background because I think it's so important for people to understand why Iran is like it is today, and it's a direct result of all of the interference that we've done in their lands. And again, you don't like the Iranians, fine. What if somebody was doing the exact same stuff to us? What would you be doing? If China was in doing to us like we were doing to Iran, what would you be doing? So I think that was a good primer of where we are. But you know, here's the problem where we are today. So we mentioned before that all of this has nothing to do with the nuclear power that Iran has. That they're doing. This has nothing to do with weapons. This has everything to do with the petrodollar and the precarious position that the United States is in. I spoke before about how the dollar is mathematically going to collapse, and they need cover to reestablish a new paradigm. And war is the best way of doing it. And if they can continue to kick the can down the road by maintaining the petrodollar standard, so that no one can really get out, then that's all the better. You have to realize that so long as oil is denominated in the dollar, all of our adversaries are forced to hold our dollars. And this is something that gives us a tremendous advantage, and that's why we're able to spend more money on our military than the rest of the world combined. This is why we're able to run up tremendous amount of debts and not have to worry about kind of Greece-like conditions where, that they can't get funding. You know, we could always print any amount of money that we need, so long as this petrodollar is there. So now there's this big push to go after Iran, because they're really the last nation out there that's a major oil exporter that isn't on the petrodollar standard. They're also a country that doesn't believe in usury, which is another thing. If you think about it, all of our paradigm is based on spreading debt and death, and here's a country that doesn't believe in usury because it's against Allah. As it was with all the religions until they got sold out. And they're now a nation that, since 2008, is a nation that's not selling oil for dollars. You know, this big move has been on to attack Iran, and I wanted to give people more understanding of why that is such a bad idea. It's almost impossible in my mind for it to work out, quote-unquote good for the United States. And why it's so important. So the Strait of Hormuz, everybody kind of gets where that is. It's at the base of the Persian Gulf. 20% of the world's oil goes through that strait, and that's 35% of all the seaborne trade for oil. Okay, it's only 21 miles wide, but most of the traffic goes through a 4-mile shipping lane. And if you look at the geography of it, Iran almost encircles the entire outside of it. So there's a lot of land that would access to shutting down that area. And if you look at it, Iran has, I think, 1,800 kilometers of oil coastline along the Persian Gulf. So it would act as a huge aircraft carrier, to project power into this area. And it's a very small area to do it. So that's why Iran does not have this formidable navy to do this, and there's, I'll get into the reasons why, but there's miles of mountainous coast to block these lanes, and it's something that can be very easily done. And so as we have three carrier groups heading over there, it's insane to think three carrier groups are going to be able to keep the Strait of Hormuz open. There's 28 oil tankers that cross the strait every day, so half of them are full, half of them are empty. So that's 14 in, 14 out, and that accounts for 17 million barrels of petroleum a day that go through the strait. Iran is the third largest oil exporter, okay? And 85% of the oil that goes through the Strait of Hormuz goes to Asia. So the United States recently has put the screws on Iran, saying, hey, we're going to ratchet up the economic sanctions. And they went on a worldwide tour to get all these other nations to say, yeah, we're against Iran and their nuclear weapons. And they were rebuffed all over the place. Korea, Japan, and China both said no way, because they know that they have so much oil coming from there. And I think that they get where Americans going with this after 10 years of the Iraq war. And they said, no way. And more importantly, right after that, Japan and China said, yeah, not only are we not going to support you with Iran, we're also going to dump the dollar in bilateral trade. So Japan and China trade, I think, $2 trillion a year in currency. And it's always been settled in dollars. You have to realize Japan was, invaded and conquered, and the founding of modern Japan is, as an American protectorate. Comes from that. So they've used the dollar in all trade. In fact, most countries have done this. And China has made step-by-step process of dumping the dollar in foreign trade to support their yuan and creating it as a reserve currency. They've done this through peaceful actions. They're not forcing other countries to say, hey, use our dollar or use our yuan or we're going to bomb you like the United States has been doing. So Japan and China said, yeah, not only are we not going to support you with Iran, we're also going to dump the dollar in bilateral trade. So that's a lot of dollars that don't need to be held overseas that are eventually going to come, back home to us where it's the only place that it can be. But I think the most important thing that people have to understand about the Strait of Hormuz and the military, American fleets going in there and looking how much technological power is, this could be a very asymmetrical war, meaning that, United States can attack Iran, but Iran doesn't have to fight the United States. All they have to do is hit these big lumbering oil tankers. And I tell you what, they blow up one of them, and you're going to see all these other oil tankers saying, uh-uh, it's a war zone, and I'm not risking it. Or insurance companies saying, hey, you go through there, we're not going to insure your ship, if it's in a war zone. Very easily could Iran destabilize the petrodollar, which is the basis of all military power that the United States has, by not even attacking the United States. And then understanding that Iran and Saudi Arabia are really diametrically opposed and they don't like each other. Iran also has the power of hitting the ports. So why even bother with ships that can move around when you can hit huge ports like this Ras Tanura that has 33 million barrels of oil just sitting there along the coast, well within the reach of these ballistic missiles that Iran has. And boom, you've really screwed up the petrodollar. Hit one of these major ports, oil flow stops or worse is being blown up and that there's this stuff. These are big fixed positions that, can't really be defended by. And Iran knows this. They spent all their defense measures on, not trying to meet the American power, but saying, hey, we know what kind of battle we're going to have to fight if you guys attack us, and we know where to hit you. And it's not just going to be, us fighting against your aircraft carriers. We'll absorb all that because we're a big mountainous, rocky, nation. And we're just going to hit you guys where it counts, and that's in the wallet, and they know that. Even Saudi Arabia's big oil fields like Ghawar and Abqi handles two-thirds of the world's oil output. All they have to do is hit the pipelines there or the transfer stations and stuff like that. Here's another thing, like the Saudi Arabia has been spending a lot of money on creating like the East-West oil pipeline and all these pipelines to get around the Persian or the Strait of Hormuz. But the problem is all of their oil terminals and most of their oil productions along the coast, well within reach of the Iranians. So even these pipelines, if the Strait of Hormuz gets shut, they're still going to hit these oil pipelines. And again, it's all about destabilizing the petrodollar and setting off all these chain reactions that the United States military cannot handle. You can't handle economic collapses. You can't handle stock market collapses and currency devaluations and China and Russia getting involved. I mean, these are all big things that just don't look good for us. Even the mightiest navy is weak inside the Persian Gulf because it's a small pond. I mean, these big fleets are really meant out to be in wide open seas and be able to be over the horizon stuff, and they can't be in the small area of the Persian Gulf, knowing that, you know, Iran has this huge coastline, a rocky fortified coastline, that basically acts as a gigantic aircraft carrier. And there's really no place for them to hide, because the Pacific, the Persian Gulf is a pretty calm, you know, area. It's not like it, you know, it's the stormy North Atlantic where they can kind of hide there. And then you also have to realize that, all right, so say like a carrier fleet ends up going to the Persian Gulf, they still have to get out. Like, if war starts, like, how do you get an aircraft carrier fleet out of that, of the Persian Gulf? You know, if once, you know, the fire starts in there, they still have to pass through the Strait of Hormuz at some point. So Iranian, this is where I want people to understand, because I think we have this, you know, mentality that we have this super awesome high tech military that can crush anything. And, you know, Iran is not Iraq. Iran is not Afghanistan. And the war that we kind of fight is not the kind of war that we've been fighting in Afghanistan and Iran. This is much more of a naval thing. And quite honestly, I think Iran's got the upper hand here, folks. So let's look at some of the weapons that they have. They have this SSN 22 Musket, and it's the most important sea warfare weapon Iran has. It was designed at the end of the Cold War by Russia specifically to avoid NATO anti-missile defenses. First of all, it's very fast. It can cruise at Mach 3 at high altitudes and Mach 2.2 near the surface of the water. And now think about this. Mach 2.2, that allows this rocket to travel across the Strait of Hormuz from any of the coast defenses in less than a minute. Okay? So anywhere along this rocky coast, they can have this Musket missile hit any target in the Strait of Hormuz in less than a minute. And it's also capable of executing random changes in directions along the way of closing into the target, thus making it very difficult for these automatic coast or automatic defenses to calculate trajectory. And it's a large missile. It weighs 4.5 tons and is capable of carrying a fairly good-sized warhead capable of sinking any of these ships. And the range, it can go way past 100 kilometers, so way far in excess of the Strait of Hormuz and even the Persian Gulf. And this is technology that was started with Russia, but then Iran has been very good at reverse engineering and creating a domestically produced weapons program, and even in advancing the versions of it. And the scary thing about this is it has an accuracy rate of 99%. Any ship that's in the Strait of Hormuz, any one of these missiles anywhere, and could be fired from a submarine, a ship, on land, and probably even through airplanes. Boom! 1 minute, you got a Mach 2 missile flying there, blowing up these ships, and you have a 99% accuracy. Once it leaves, it's going to hit its intended target. I think another weapon that the Iranians have that I think is pretty impressive is the Hoot torpedo. This is a weapon. The Hoot torpedo is a super cavitating torpedo that travels through the water inside of a gas bubble that greatly reduces friction. This is faster than any torpedo that NATO has and can reach speeds of 200 knots. So when you think about, you know, the average oil tanker probably moves at 20 knots, this is a very devastating weapon in naval combat. And it's also very difficult to defend against. This is another weapon that the Iranians have developed all by themselves. So, that, I mean, this is some serious technology that they have going on here. Not only does it have impressive speed, but it also maintains the effectiveness of these torpedoes. The range is relatively small and should be noisy enough to be identified at launch, but these weapons are produced by Iran, and their main threat is that they're able to produce a lot of them. So they have these subs, they have missile ships, they have small speedboats that can launch these anti-ship missiles and torpedoes. And the small navy is the whole purpose of this small navy and their whole defense strategy is really hitting these larger ships with these small forces. And you know, you hear about these little teeny speedboats and we go, oh, you know, what are they going to do against, you know, these multi-ton aircraft carriers and destroyers and stuff like that? Well, when you're able to pop on, you know, a couple of these Hoot torpedoes and some of these Musket missiles, it doesn't take much to knock these ships out. The Iranian Air Force is probably not as effective as even their Navy. It's old. It's a lot of Russian and Chinese fighter jets. But again, they realize if they're going to dump a lot of the money into, you know, defense, do stuff that's going to cause the most amount of bang for the impact. And I think their missiles and their torpedoes and all that other type stuff is very formidable. And when you consider, you know, one of these, you know, torpedoes might cost a couple hundred thousand dollars and it could, you know, disable or destroy a billion-dollar aircraft carrier, it's amazing. So their Air Force is not the largest. It does have some, you know, newer MiGs that the Russians have done. Nothing I don't think our Air Force could take care of. And that's why the Iranians have not built their whole defense system around stuff that we're the strongest at. This is asymmetrical. And they want to hit things where they're going to get the most bang for their buck. That being said, the air defenses of capabilities of Iran are much stronger than Iraq. Everybody forgets that Iraq was 10 years of no-fly zones, and we, you know, blew up all their radars and all that other stuff before we went in there. We're not going to have that ability of prepping the target with, you know, if they do attack Iran, which I'll get into why they won't. But again, that's also provided by Russia and China. Again, you know, providing more legitimacy or more connection with the anti-hegemon that China and Russia represents. One of the major things that I found why I don't believe America will challenge Iran in this open kind of warfare scenario, this Millennium Challenge that I found in 2002, is one of the most expensive war exercises the United States has ever carried out. It was done in 2002. And it was specifically designed to see how Iran would react to United States aggression. And they you know, role-played that Iran would launch a massive barrage of missiles that would overwhelm the United States and destroy 16 U.S. naval vessels, including an aircraft carrier, 10 cruisers, and 5 amphibious ships. And they estimated that the real-world theater would result in 20,000 U.S. servicemen dying on the very first day following an attack. That's our best case scenario back in 2002. And when you realize, you know, what we're up against, we're up against a nation that has 1,800 kilometers of coastline. It's rocky. They've been preparing for this. They have all their defenses lined up for this asymmetrical warfare, the Strait of Hormuz. You know, being able to take on. You know, technically superior, you know, military by using all these missiles, these anti-ship missiles, and knowing that the petrodollar is the backbone of all of this, man, like, what do you do? You know, like, you can't attack. It's absolute insane to attack. And then, you know, like I said before, they don't even have to attack the aircraft carriers or the battleships or the cruisers or whatever else they have going on in there. All they have to do is hit these tankers and they're done. All they have to do is hit these ports, you know, the Saudi Arabian ports and they're done. So here's kind of a historical context of looking at it. It's very much like what the German U-boats did against England. You know, they don't have to take on the British Navy. All they have to do is hit the supply ships, and they weakened and really hurt England that way. Well, it's the exact same thing in reverse. You know, Iran prevents the oil tankers from flowing, and you do far more economic damage to a country than trying to take them on head on. And that's exactly what the Iranians are doing. Here's another thing I don't think people realize. Iran is not Iraq. Iran is not Afghanistan. That's nothing. Iraq had 32 million Iraqis in their country. Their economy was only $82 billion. And Iraq was also under sanctions and no-fly zones for 10 years before we went into Iraq. Afghanistan, a little bit bigger population, much more difficult terrain. But they're like Stone Age. I mean, their entire world or their entire economy is only $17 billion. And when you think about the size of Apple Computer at $500 billion, $17 billion is nothing. That's like, God, that's probably like the broccoli industry in the United States. I mean, you know, something of that equivalent. It's nothing. Iran is much bigger, okay? It's twice the size of Iraq and Afghanistan, both in terms of population, and it's probably three times larger in size of geography. Iran is bigger than Germany and France, like most of Europe combined. It's a huge piece of land. It's very mountainous. It's most of its population's up by Tehran, which is well away from American military bases that are surrounding Iran, very close to Russia. So there's 78 million Iranians. Their economy is much larger. It's 330 billion, so it's almost four times the size of Iraq's economy, meaning that their population is much better, well off. I've seen pictures of Tehran. It's a very modern city. They have ski resorts. They have a middle class. They have this isn't some backwoods Bedouin, kind of Afghanistan destroyed by years of war. Iran's, they got it going on. And the Persian people are not sealed themselves in as a unified country, mainly because of what the United States has been doing to them for the last 50 years. They've kind of reinforced how, that they're really against the way that the rest of the world functions. The Iranians do not like the Saudis. So when you hear about Saudi Arabia giving the go-ahead for Israel to attack Iran, that doesn't mean anything. The Saudis are, just as part of this mess as the Israelis are, because it's still a part of the Anglo-American Empire. We have treated the Saudis very well. The Saudis have been our boys for a long time. We put them in power. We give them the oil contracts. They supply us with the oil. We supply them with protection. They're diametrically opposed to the Iranians, because the Iranians have lived against the Anglo-American Empire and have not benefited from it. And another thing, the Iranians look at the Saudis like a bunch of Muslim mobsters. In fact, I heard one Iranian say that the very fact that the House of Saud named the country Saudi Arabia is arrogant as naming, America Bush Clinton land, or, something like, Bush America or something like that, because that's the equivalent of what they named, the House of Saud, saying this is all theirs. And they're opposed to them, not only politically because of the Anglo-American Empire, but also religiously. Okay, so the Iranians are Shia or Shiite Muslims. And I had to look this up because I don't quite get the difference between the two of them. But there's a difference between the Shiite Muslims and the Sunni Muslims. And for those that don't understand, the Shiite Muslims believe that after the Prophet Muhammad's death, that the leadership should pass directly through his cousin and son-in-law, Ali, and that throughout all of history, the Shiite Muslims have not recognized the authority of any elected Muslim leaders, instead choosing only to follow the line of imams, which they believe have been appointed by the Prophet Muhammad or Allah himself. The way of looking at it is, it's almost like, the Shiite Muslims are the Catholic Church of Muslims, and that there was a breakaway of the Sunni Muslims, who believe that the leaders of the Muslim religion should come from those that are among the most capable of the job. So it's more of a, who's the most powerful guy, who's the most, who's the best leader. And the way I look at it is, it's very much along the same line of, the Catholic and the Protestant split, where the Catholic Church said, hey, we're the original, Christian church, and, all power comes down through this, power structure that we have set up. And then the Protestants are like, no, we believe in the word of God, and we don't need to have your power structure to do this. And this led to all these other religious leaders saying, hey, I'm going to create my own religion. Well, in fact, all they're doing is creating their own little power paradigm, which they dominate. And this allows the Shiites, in this case, to, create other religions outside of the original one, which is, the Shiite or the Shiite one. And if you think about it, all these centralized organizations, whether it's, in these churches or, in the Muslim case or in all this other stuff, anytime that there's a breakaway, usually it's to benefit some new elite that's going to profit off that new centralized paradigm. Even though the Shiite Muslims, which the Iranians most respond with, they're a small percentage of all the Muslims. 85% of the Muslims are more like the Sunnis, like the Saudis and the all these other parts of the Arabian area are mostly Sunni, religious-wise. So there's, again, another difference between Iran and Saudi Arabia, which are the two main powers there. So not only the Anglo-Americans, but also the religious context of it. Iran is also especially pissed off because the recent oil sanctions have given more sales to Saudi Arabia. So here they have the Anglo-American Empire world saying, hey, we're going to cut you off with oil sales, and that directly benefits Saudi Arabia. And Iran even warned Saudi Arabia, don't pick up the slack, because if you guys cut off oil to us, we're going to view you as the enemy. So the next big thing that has happened, I think this happened yesterday on St. Patrick's Day, the Anglo-American Empire shut down the SWIFT system, which is the banking system that facilitates all these bank transfers for major institutions. So just like if you wire money through, from local places through, like TransUnion, you're probably using the FedWire, which is the Federal Reserve wire transfer system, to do that. Well, in this scenario, the SWIFT system it's a Belgian-based company. That is what facilitates all these big oil sales and stuff like that. So prior to yesterday, I guess, all the money that comes in and out of Iran would have to go through the SWIFT system, whether it's people transferring money to Iranian relatives or, oil contracts. The SWIFT system is what facilitated that. Well, not only did they cut it off and they telegraphed that they were going to do this, all this has done is furthered allow Iran to ratchet it up. And they said, okay, fine, you guys don't want us using your SWIFT system. Our oil is not only for sale for in 2008, they opened up their oil bourse in the Isle of Kish, and that's when I did that video with Seymour Hersh with Dick Cheney, even back in 2008, trying to drum up a war with Iran. So this has really been put off to the side for almost 4 years. But when they opened up that oil bourse, they not only said that they're not selling oil for dollars, they said that we'll sell it for euros, reals, yuan, rubles, we'll sell it for any currency. But now, with the SWIFT system set out, the first deal that they did after the Iranians got shut down, they did a deal with India for gold for oil. And that was another big shot. I mean, the Anglo-Americans have to be going nuts because they said, Iran's bad because of their nukes, and the rest of the world's going, no, we do business with them. They haven't given us any reason not to support them or stuff like that. And quite honestly, with the Anglo-American having this petrodollar and all the wars that you guys have been fighting and involved in Libya and Iraq and Afghanistan, we're not going to fall for this one. So India, who's, up until recently, I would have been like, yeah, they're with us. No, they're not. Pakistan, another nation that, you would say was a former ally of us, they're definitely not moving with us, especially after the fake Osama bin Laden and us shooting all down. The Musharraf and all these guys over there, these are American put-up guys, and they're closing ties with us. Hamid Karzai, another guy who's been put up there by us. His brother's one of the largest drug dealers in Afghanistan with the heroin production. He's telling America to get out. America is losing ground all over the place in this Iranian thing. They don't have the international backing like they did with Iraq, which is more of a reason why I feel like this is coming to a head. Because it's like the world is aligning against us, the United States. Our dollars on the verge, I feel, of this mathematical collapse. The petrodollar starting to lose. Every day that Iran's able to transport oil for any other currency and empowers all these other countries, especially China and Japan and Korea, that really rely upon Iranian oil, and gives further weakening to the dollar. With China and Japan dropping bilateral trade, in terms of dollar, that's $2 trillion that doesn't need to be held overseas, that can be used to buy up assets all over the world or dumping it into the commodities. With Iran being able to get away with get away with selling oil for any other currency out there, that hurts the dollar. You know, Russia and China have dropped the dollar for bilateral trade. It's like the whole world's starting to wake up to this whole petrodollar thing and doing what I'm encouraging, walking away from the paradigm. You don't have to confront, you know, the United States to for them to take it down. All they have to do is just walk away from it. So much the same way that I'm saying, hey, you don't like supporting these wars. You don't like supporting these deficits. You don't like supporting these corporations that are, you know, exporting all of our jobs overseas and creating tons of profits, and that they're, you know, that they're not invested in the United States and our industries. Like, I mean, you look at, geez, Henry Ford. I mean, he was a billionaire of the time, and he raised the wages of Americans, you know, to $5 a day, which was unheard of. But he realized that in order to create a middle class, in order to buy his products, he had to make sure that they had money. And that's not the case that we have today. We have all these rich billionaires who are all about extracting wealth from the middle class and not building it up. You know, even, you know, it's a total parasitic system now. So much the same way that I'm encouraging people to get their money out of the paper paradigm, to walk away from it, not only because it's going to fail and that this is something that you need to do defensively, but it's also going to benefit you because if you buy real tangible assets, that's where you're going to, you know, the silver bullet and the silver shield. Well, what, you know, China, Russia, and, you know, all these other countries are doing is logical. You know, the dollar paradigm, it goes against the innate national interests of those countries. So why support it? Walk away from it. You don't have to confront the United States and all their military power. Walk away from it. So with the SWIFT system that shut down and the telegraphing that it was going to shut down, Iran has gone through, and again, this is that same destabilization that the British did when they took down Mossadegh and they took down the Shah. They're trying to foment internal strife inside Iran, so it makes it more difficult for Iran to mount any sort of defense. And as a result of this, the new pressures, the Iranian rial, which is their currency, has suffered a 60% devaluation in 6 months at the end of 2011. So from September to December, the Iranian rial lost 60% of its value. In fact, between August and December, 40 tons of gold were sold. 40 tons of gold were sold between August and December through the Iranian National Bank, to the point where there was no more gold to be sold, and the government had to outlaw selling rials for any foreign currency or gold. So I think this is a very important factor. Knowing that that is a way of, you know, if the rial dropped 60%, that means in real terms, gold went up 60%. I'm sure it went even higher than that after the government outlawed sales of reals to gold. But knowing that currency controls are definitely something the government's going to do. So when and if this all kicks off and that we start seeing gold and silver start moving, don't be surprised if they do, you know, outlaw it. But you know what? That doesn't mean that you still don't get there ahead of time, because once the dollar starts collapsing and they get desperate enough, it's over for that currency. And that the only way to protect yourself is to have real tangible value. And it would further drive that kind of currency into the black market. So all these sanctions that the Anglo-American Empire is pushing on Iran is acts of war in my mind. You know, if China was doing the same stuff to us, we would be like out of our mind. You know, you're going to block our oil sales. You're going to block capitals coming into the United States. You're going to seal us off from the rest of the world. You're going to patrol your ships on our Gulf Coast, and you're going to say, you know, all this stuff. These are acts of war, and this is exactly what the United States did to Japan to get them to attack us, to cause that war, to get us involved and have them fire the first shot. United States was the largest oil exporter, and we were also the largest steel producer. And just prior to the Pearl Harbor attack, we cut off oil and steel sales, forcing them to take the risky attack of attacking the United States at Pearl Harbor. And we also had broken their code, their secret code, so we knew that they were coming. And all of our aircraft carriers were out to sea. So the most important ships in the Pacific War, which was known for the aircraft carriers, not one of them was in Pearl Harbor. And the only ships were there were old, you know, World War I vessels that were probably going to be decommissioned and stuff like that. And that gave us the rallying cry to get the United States involved in the war. And as soon as that happened, it's like, you know, the whole world changed again. So there has to be some sort of false flag to get us involved in there, because we're not going to willingly attack Iran knowing that we have so much going against us. They need to have it look like the Iranians are doing it. So knowing that the Americans know that it's a no-win situation, that they probably lose 20,000 American servicemen on the first day Iranian retaliation, I don't think Iran's going to attack us either. They benefit from the status quo. The longer they drag this out, the more powerful their position becomes, even though there's a lot of economic consequences of having these sanctions. But all it's doing is making further and deeper ties with nations like Russia, China, India, and Pakistan, even Venezuela. I mean, there's strong ties there, and possibly Brazil. All these non-aligned, anti-hegemon nations, it's making it, that they're still going to do trade with them. So who does that leave to cause this? I mean, there's obviously this war drum that's being beat. It's not in America's best interest to pull off this attack by themselves, because they would run the risk of losing world support, which I don't think anything is going to be able to do that. They have to have some sort of false flag. We've already seen how Cheney in the Seymour Hersh video said that, they can't have Americans attacking Americans. Well, who's left? It's Israel. And you know what? Who's to say that they wouldn't pull off the false flag? Israel's saying that they're going to attack Iran. As much as it's insane for the United States to attack Iran, it's beyond insane for Israel to attack it. They're 2,000 miles away. They would have to refuel, then have to deal with Iranian air defenses, plus not be guaranteed that they're going to accomplish what they're going to do. And they don't have the ability of continuing this. I mean, if they did one big strike, what's the chances that they're going to get a second shot at it? And then what does the world look like? They got Syria, they got the Hezbollah, they got, they remember in 2006 they had all those rockets. They were attacked. Now Egypt's not even as friendly as they were after this new regime is in, after Mubarak's out. Israel, they don't have a good thing. So they're barking like a dog there, saying, attack, attack, attack. And they put the screws on. Recent things that I had read that Benjamin Netanyahu's, I'm not a fan of Obama, but I mean, the guy's almost talking to Obama like he's a child. The only reason why I think we haven't had war with Iran the last 4 years is because of the Obama administration, probably because they're listening to the American military guys saying, hey, we can't handle an attack on the United on Iran. I mean, we can't guarantee to keep the Strait of Hormuz open. I mean, that's just, it's not possible. And the economic consequences are big. And yet you still have this constant drumbeat from the only people that really want the war, which is these neocons that got us involved in Iraq. And the head dude is Benjamin Netanyahu, who's this chief hawk, who to me is all the signs of a psychopath. I was talking with an American Jewish person who said that, even inside Israel, Netanyahu does not have the support of most of the Israeli people who don't want war with Iran. They see it, they've been trying to sell it as a nuclear threat, and that, that they could wake up one day with a mushroom cloud, much like, Bush was saying that with Iraq. But they don't want it. They don't want war with them. In fact, there's a lot of big guys that are coming out against Netanyahu. But this guy said, and I thought it was pretty interesting that he says that, he said that Netanyahu reminds him of the way that he deals with politics in Israel is very much how Stalin dealt with it. Like, he would be watching to see who stops clapping first. Like, don't cross this guy. Like, he's nobody to mess around with. And, I think he's the most dangerous guy in the world right now because he's doing this. Here Israel has said basically to Obama, either you attack by the end of this year or you're not going to get the Jewish support for your reelection. We all know that AIPAC is probably the most powerful lobby inside the United States right now. So that's a pretty big thing. So Obama is continuing to pay lip service to it. Meanwhile, we have the three presidential guys that are left, now that Ron Paul is basically out of this race, they were at AIPAC at the beginning of this month, basically saying, who could bomb the most. And I don't believe that Mitt Romney is the guy to do it, even though I think he's most likely going to be the nomination. And I still think Obama's going to win the election. I don't think Mitt Romney has his heart into it, because in the 2008 election, he didn't go after the Jewish vote like everybody else. And yet the guy who did go after it, John McCain, if you remember, his campaign was dead, broke. He had no shot of winning. And as soon as he started doing that bomb, Iran, and got the Jewish vote, he went right on to win all these primaries and steal the election from Mitt Romney, who looked like he was the front runner there. But now that Bush has backed Mitt Romney, I think he's going to be the ultimate choice. It'll be guaranteed that his VP pick will be some neocon. And quite honestly, right now, out of the three guys, Newt Gingrich is the one that seems to be the most bloodthirsty out of the three of them. His speech at AIPAC was like, I would never stop Israel from attacking Iran. And basically it was like he was the one that was going to bomb them the most. So it'll be interesting to see how this happens. But now that Ron Paul's out, the time frame between now and the election starts to become a very crunch time, where the Israelis feel that they have the most amount of pressure to apply on the Obama administration to pull off the attack. And my big fear is that the Americans, as much as they want to support the petrodollar, they'd much rather a long-term decline. And perhaps having something happen instead of trying to play off another preemptive strike. So this leads me back down to considering the fact that the neocons in Israel are the only ones really in the whole world. I mean, you got Russia, China, Iran, even the United States, England, Europe. Nobody seems to want war with Iran because there's so much money that's still flowing around the world. Why throw it all up in the air? Seems like the Israelis are the only ones that really want this war, and we've shown before that they're just not capable of fighting Iran by themselves. It's a complete inconceivability. The logistics, their ability, Iran, it's just not going to happen. That doesn't mean that we saw that Cheney said, we can't have Americans killing Americans with that Seymour Hersh thing causing. This casus bellus, cataclysmic event to cause war. But what's to say that the Israelis don't pull off a false flag and that they sink a ship? So I put a video about the 1964 attack of the USS Liberty, and that's exactly what the Israelis did. They had their six-day war with Egypt, with the Sinai Peninsula, and they wanted to get the United States involved. So what did they do? They had these ships and unmarked Israeli ships and unmarked Israeli planes bomb and strafe the USS Liberty, which was the most decorated ship of the time, with napalm and I think white phosphorus, and try to sink the ship, and they couldn't. And it was only stopped because there was Russian spy planes in the area observing this whole thing. And that prevented us from getting involved in the Israel-Egypt war back in 1964. Well, folks, the USS Enterprise being decommissioned, there's all these videos going around there saying, wow, how easy would it be for somebody to attack the USS Liberty or Enterprise, sink it, considering it's going to be decommissioned anyways. It's got 8 reactors on board, which is a very expensive process. Not that money's ever an option for these guys, but certainly not something that they're going to make a ton of money off of. And that would enable, much like how 9/11 did, the outrage of America and us being, saying, hey, you guys attacked us. We have every right to defend us. And that could keep Russia and China at bay, much like that, how that happened with the Iraq war. I don't even know if that's going to keep Russia and China at bay, because I'm sure that they've learned a lot of lessons by then. The Anglo-Americans trying to put sanctions on Syria and close them off. Both Russia and China have both said, no, not going to happen. We're members of the UN Security Council. We had 2 of the 5 votes. Not going to happen. We're not going to allow you guys to go ahead and keep doing this stuff. And getting back to Netanyahu, there is not even that much support inside of his cabinet. He just did a vote, and he only got 8 out of the 14 votes to allow Israel to go all alone against Iran. And even the ex-Mossad chief, Meir Dagan, said that an attack on Iran would be one of the most incredibly insane things to do, and that they need to practice military restraint and political initiative, and form, negotiate with these people and tone down the rhetoric instead of ratcheting it up. So that's a pretty big guy to come out against Netanyahu, which is my hope is that more saner heads come to this, because we can't just continue to, cause war to continue this paradigm. It has to end at some point. Plus, Meir Dagan pointed out that the Israel not only would have to deal with a long range war with a nation much larger than that, and that there's still no guarantees, even if they do hit their targets, that they're going to destroy the targets, because some of the stuff is built underground. Israel then has to deal with Syria and Hezbollah all over again, and it's been 6 years since the 06 attacks, where they launched, I think, 30,000 rockets into Israel, that they would have to deal with that. And, if Israel is now doing preemptive war, I mean, you're going to cause a lot of upset all over the world, and that this doesn't benefit them, and Israel's not ready for it. So to back up the invasion before the end of this year. So, I've read that Netanyahu basically put Obama on notice, basically saying that if he doesn't conduct this war by the end of this year, the Israeli lobby is going to pull their support from him, and he's not going to win his re-election. And everybody realizes how important AIPAC is in terms of funding and getting people elected. But there's also news that Hillary Clinton has told the Russians that it's not a matter of if, but when, and that this is going to happen, and that the Iranians need to prepare for this. And the Russian foreign minister said, there is no last chance for this, that's unprofessional, and a war will not solve any problems, but create millions of new ones. So immediately the Russians are like, no, you guys don't get it. You guys don't get to pull this last chance thing, that they don't believe that, Iran's developing nuclear weapons, that they're doing it for nuclear power. And this comes on the heels of Putin coming back into the picture. I mean, he's been out of the picture for the last 4 years, and he just won the presidential term for the next 6 years. So now it's a 6-year term. So he's going to be there till 2018. And this guy is a sharp dude. I mean, he took down the Rothschild oligarchs, kind of got Russia back on its feet after a disastrous collapse of the Soviet Union, has put them, back on the map in terms of global power. And he's a strategic thinker, and he's not going to stand aside and let the Anglo-Americans encircle Russia, much less this last piece of the Anglo-American oil empire with Iran. In fact, he's actually looking to create further ties besides the military contracts that he has with Iran and the trade that they have with Iran and their assistance in producing these nuclear power plants. Russia wants to form a gas OPEC with Iran, and I think between the two nations, they would control something like 50% of the world's natural gas supply. And if you've seen the price of natural gas over the past couple of years, it's been lagging while the oil prices have been going up. So here's Russia with Putin back in control for the next 6 years. I read a big piece that he wrote, and to be honest, he sounds more like Ron Paul than any other guy out there. He called the revolting slaughter of Muammar Gaddafi was not just medieval but primeval, and that the United States should not be allowed to pull the same Libyan thing in Syria. So that's very strong words from a Russian president to say that. He sees that these pseudo-NGOs, these non-governmental organizations who come across as, humanitarian efforts or, not politically involved, organizations, kind of like this Invisible Children. That would be an example of an NGO. It's not really a governmental thing, but it definitely has suspicious backgrounds. George Soros used a lot of NGOs to support all these color revolutions and former Soviet nations like Belarus and pumped a lot of money into their organizations to provide propaganda. And here's Putin saying that these NGOs and agencies are destabilizing these countries from the outside, and that's unacceptable. He says Russia does not use or fund NGOs based in other countries or any other foreign political organization in pursuit of its own interests, along with China, India, and Brazil do not do that either. We believe that any influence on domestic policy and public attitude in other countries must be exerted in the open in this way, and those who wish to influence it to do so responsibly. Basically saying that the Americans, this is a big linchpin of the Anglo-American Empire, is using the soft power to foment revolution, to control political outcomes in other nations. And here he's saying, you know, hey guys, we see what you're doing and we're not for this. And then he turns his attention to Iran. He says, Russia is very worried about the growing threat of a military strike against Iran. If this happens, the consequences would be disastrous. It's impossible to imagine the true scope of the turn of events. And he goes on to say, he goes, you know, you guys are all, you know, all excited about Iran having possibly nuclear weapons one day. He goes, let me recall that we have North Korea and Russia share a common border and that we don't choose neighbors. And what are we doing with a nation that is, you know, illegally going after nuclear weapons and has said so? He says, we did these six nation talks and we're talking about it and we've toned down the rhetoric and you know, we're seeking you know, negotiations to end this, not ratchet up the thing and declare war. And he goes, look at what you guys are doing in Afghanistan. He says, you know, Afghanistan, you know, the main threat to us is the illegal drug trafficking, and that it's become a very urgent threat to us, and it undermines the genetic bank of entire nations, creating a fertile soil for corruption and crime, leading to the destabilization of Afghanistan. And far from declining, the production of Afghan drugs has increased 40% over last year. So people, you know, like I've said before, the Taliban actually shut down oil opium production in Afghanistan, and was actually killing the farmers because they said it was an affront to Allah. And it wasn't until the United States went in there and took over again that the CIA and all these other organizations, you know, reestablished opium production and actually have increased it year over year doing that. So the United States is definitely involved in the drug trade. And here's Russia saying, hey, you guys are, you know, involved in that too. It's like, you know, it's like all the stuff that we're talking about on our own political level here, walking away from the system, that's what the anti-hegemon's doing. All the playbook that the Anglo-American Empire has been having, that they've successfully used, is all out in the open, and everybody gets it. And there's really no way for the Anglo-American Empire to turn this around without having some sort of massive destabilization, World War III, where all the chips are on the table, and we have to, you know, they have to rule the world, you know, by destroying the world. And fortunately, the other nations that are out there have seen this, and they can call it out there. And my hope is that if they do pull a false flag, my hope is that you know, the world says, "Hey, before you guys go to war, we have to find out what the real story is. We're not going to be rushed into another war because of this." We'll hope that you know, the internet folks are able to tear apart whatever that false flag is, much the same way that this Kony 2012 example happened. You know, here is this video that got 80 million views in 10 days, and then we come to find out that it's, you know, basically a drummed up drumbeat for a war for oil, because Uganda now has oil, just like we were talking about with Darfur earlier. And my hope is that with, you know, that we can, you know, stop this before we get crazy. I mean, the World War III is nothing to be cheering for, and I can't get over the amount of, you know, people I read on these blogs, especially these pseudo-Christian, you know, Israeli things going, oh, you know, we have to, you know, nuke Iran, and, you know, this is great, and, you know, Israel. No, folks, this is, you're guaranteeing Israel being destroyed by this. I mean, if you really believe in Israel, you should be invoking peace. They should be negotiating with them. They should stop, you know, stop rolling over these Palestinian settlements. They need to ratchet down the rhetoric. If you truly want Israel to survive, and that's the best way for it to survive, is to become friendly with these people, not being this big bully on the block with the United States doing all the fighting for them. And that's the reason why in that video I did, the three coming false flags. I really think the only way that the Anglo-American Empire is going to be able to kind of fail forward is by doing this, these three false flags, and address all three of the major challenges to the empire right now, which is the military threat from the anti-hegemon represented by China, Russia, Iran, Venezuela, you know, now Pakistan and India, you know, possibly, you know, Japan, you know, all these other nations that are lying against it because they don't benefit from the current paradigm. The mathematical collapse of the dollar. They would have to create some sort of new currency. That's not going to happen. You know, you're not going to wipe away all of America's wealth in one shot, and that they're going to somehow be able to reestablish it without a major war to rally everybody against. And then the final thing, which is the most scary to me and the people that do the kind of stuff that I do, is this internet false flag where, you know, they shut down websites. They really, you know, close down people's right to free speech you know, that's a dangerous time there, but yeah, that's the only way that I could see the Anglo-American Empire to continue dominating the world, which is what they're all about. I mean, God, that's all they've done is spread debt and death throughout the world. Now it's coming to a point where their whole system is on the line, and what do they do? So, you know, Iran seems to be the collision course here, and I really hope that we're able to avoid this and somehow, you know, hopefully this collapses before we're able to commit to a larger war that would entail so many nations. I mean, all China would have to do is just start dumping dollars, and it would do more economic damage to this country than, you know, sinking all the aircraft carriers that we have. I mean, it's a scary thing. So I hope this gives you a good idea about all the different moving pieces here, and I hope this was an interesting Silver Shield report, and we'll be back next week. Thanks.